The Department of Mad Scientists, how DARPA is remaking our world from the internet to artificial limbs. We'll get more from Michael Belfiore about our future coming up in just a second. Also, the failed DARPA experiments. I want to know more about the things that DARPA has tried to do, which can now be declassified. And that's kind of the key thing for this book. A lot of the material has been recently declassified and offered to Michael Belfiore for the first time. And so you're getting an inside look at an agency that has not spent a lot of time, you know, putting windows up over their labs, if you know what I mean. So we'll get to that. Also, if you go online at coasttocoastam.com, there's some great news stories up there. I put on the blog a link to a story that pertained to yesterday's conversation we were having in the first hour about the Muslim mafia, the so-called underworld that is the FBI is tracking. It may or may not have anything to do with the Fort Hood, Texas shooter. He just may have been just unhinged enough to do this sort of thing no matter where he was. But there seems to be a link from a lot of these Islamic centers and a lot of these mosques to some fairly radical funding that's coming in from outside of the United States, which is intended to try to disrupt as much as possible life as we know it. So is it full-blown terrorist sleeper cells? Not exactly sure yet, but it's worth going back and taking a listen to if you go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for Streamlink. But anyway, back to the blog. I put up a link yesterday to that CNN story about this guy, Major Nadal Hassan, and how he would dress in the morning before getting into his military uniform. What did it mean? Does it speak to how he was living this sort of split identity, or how he was, you know, had disassociated himself from his military assignment and was living this sort of secret life? Maybe, but it might be worth taking a look at. Also, there's a couple other interesting links up for yesterday's blog as well. So it's right there at the website, coasttocoastam.com. And then, too, you know, some of this DARPA technology is there to help people who have been suffering in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a good chunk of the beginning of the book is about these new prosthetic limbs, which could be offering new hope to victims of these, you know, these improvised exploding devices that catch, you know, take limbs off left and right. And right now prevent a lot of people from returning to active service, but maybe not in the future, thanks to DARPA. That's one of the successes so far. What about some of the failures in our future next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Michael Belfiore, what were some of, you know, of all the projects, and we can't even tell the number of DARPA-funded projects that have gone on either with their full-time personnel or with the personnel that they bring in through special funding. We don't know how many projects they've had or what the success rate is. But they, in your research, you had to have come across some splendid failures, haven't you?
Yeah. One of the most interesting ones to me was, well, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know about this, remote viewing.
Right. Of course. And we were just actually, there's something about that coming up later on this week.
Yeah. And, of course, there's a lot of speculation about what exactly was the military doing with remote viewing. Was it successful? I've talked to people who really feel that this technology does work, and it was developed, and we just don't know about it because it's secret still. But we do know that DARPA was involved in that. There were people at SRI, which is actually the second node on the DARPA-funded internet. SRI, Stanford Research Institute, was funding research into psychic powers. Can we manipulate objects remotely with our minds? Can we spy on the Soviets? That's one of the big things they were interested in. Is it possible to sit in a room in California and spy on military bases within the Soviet Union without actually traveling there? And DARPA was involved in that study. The head of DARPA at the time when I was writing my book, Tony Tether, has said, hey, okay, maybe this was crazy, maybe this was a dead end, but hey, our mission is to prevent technological surprise. What if the Soviets had gotten this technology first and it was possible, then we'd really be in trouble. So that's one of DARPA's missions, to go off in these side roads of science and try to see, okay, maybe it does look like a dirt road that goes nowhere, but maybe it leads to a superhighway somewhere in the future.
And your belief is the DARPA guys told you that this never produced any fruit.
Yeah, that's sort of the story. I believe it. I haven't seen any evidence. Oh, I've talked to people I do respect who do feel. One of these is Robert Bigelow, who people listening probably have heard from also, who bought the ranch in Utah where cattle mutilations were going on.
Right.
He ran NIDS, the research organization looking into unexplained phenomena. I wrote about him in my last book, Rocketeers, because he is a Las Vegas real estate developer who's now expanding into outer space. He's building the first commercial space station.
Right.
And inspired by his belief that UFOs exist, they are real, there are aliens out there waiting for contact from us. And he absolutely believes in remote viewing. He feels that the military projects that were funded in the 70s and perhaps later did bear fruit, and he says that he's done his own independent research with his own money to find that these things are true. So, you know.
But then also, I understand this just from a promo that was just running, that there's also, there'd been some DARPA research in the past on time travel. Did you come across that?
No, I haven't heard that one. That's very interesting. Yeah, this guest of yours apparently involved as a child, or
it's George Norrie has the guest coming up later on in the week, and I think it's on Monday night, and I want to hear it, but that wouldn't surprise you to hear that either. That sounds like a typical DARPA funded project to see whether or not there could be anything to this time travel thing.
Sure, they are always looking at it's like this. So people who come into the agency, if they already believe, well, this is not possible, that's not someone they want. They want someone who, instead of says why not?
Right.
But again, there's a fine line. These are people who are well trained, for the most part, who've done already a lot of research in their fields, who made a lot of progress in various things, but who also are willing to go beyond what most people are in terms of thinking of what's possible.
What about alien technology? I mean, I know that that's a huge, you know, file of speculation and all, but did that come up when you were doing your research on DARPA, things that they were trying to test out theoretically that might have appeared in a Star Trek episode other than the surgical pods? And I mean, what else were they working on that might have sounded very science fiction-y?
Energy weapons are a big one they've been working on since very early on. This idea is very enticing to the military, that you have a weapon that just emits energy and disables of an aircraft or perhaps can kill someone. They were most interested in this for anti-ballistic missile defense.
Right. Star Wars technology
Star
in
Wars
space.
Star Wars type stuff. Yeah, and DARPA has been all over that, and they've put lots and lots of money into this. And so far, as far as I know, that hasn't borne fruit in the way it had been hoped, because, you know, shooting a physical object at a supersonic or hypersonic missile is really tough to do. But, you know, of course, energy moving at the speed of light, much better chance of hitting the target.
Right.
But some interesting spinoffs have come from that. And one of these is the lasers that they're used in LASIK eye surgery. That research came out of DARPA projects to find energy weapons. They developed.
How about that?
Yeah, halide excimer lasers came from DARPA research. Well, okay, we couldn't shoot down a missile, but hey, we can do these other interesting things with lasers. They're trying to make them small, compact,
sure,
easily portable.
Is there a back end for DARPA on that, financially speaking? Do they get that if they've developed something like that? Do they license the technology and then the taxpayer gets a return on it, or is it like NASA, it's just sort of an open-ended, here's what we found out, go make money on it?
It's more like that.
Their
mission is to prove that something is possible. So they take some idea, like, can we build a robot arm that's indistinguishable from a native arm?
Or right.
Can we build a car that can drive itself autonomously? Can we build an automated surgical suite that you don't need a surgeon to operate? Once they've proven that something like this works, they'll create a demonstration of some kind or a prototype. then the researchers that they have funded, again, they don't have their own laboratories. They farm out this work. Those researchers they farm out to then have the right to go market that on their own. The government still retains the right to use it as they like without additional compensation. But the researchers are typically, unless it's a secret project, typically free to go out and market that. So that's why a lot of these things have ended up in our own houses.
It's the Department of Mad Scientists, how DARPA is remaking our world from the internet to artificial limbs. And so those are some of our failures. I think the thing you dropped in there is a good door into the discussion about how DARPA is going to be remaking our future as well with this auto car. We were talking about it last night. That may sound redundant, auto car, but automatic car, because I was reading about this, that, you know, this is the car that you can put it on autopilot. It'll park itself. It'll drive you to where you're going. Nothing sounds dumber to me than having that kind of a card. Frankly, it sounds really uninteresting. But I understand there's a whole generation of people coming up, millennials in particular, that might love that. It makes perfect sense to them. This is technology that's really in the next, 5 years available.
Yes, really close. There was a series of races that DARPA sponsored called the Challenge, the Grand Challenge races. The last one was in 2007 that I went to and wrote about in my book. This is the grand finale. We've got cars that can race through open country during the first two races. Now let's put that technology on city streets. Let's see if we can have autonomous vehicles, not even remote controlled, vehicles driving themselves without any human input. Can we have them, you know, stopping at intersections, waiting for traffic to clear? Can we have them doing left turns? Follow traffic laws, something as simple as that. Park by themselves, like you said. And what's interesting is that they're really, well, as I said, this is purposed for DARPA, for the military. They want to have supply convoys that don't risk human drivers going through war zones. But again, this technology can be licensed by the companies developing it. So GM and Volkswagen, other places like this are involved. There's two main groups of people who are going to be interested in this. One is the millennials.
Right.
You know, we've got more and more stories in the news about people texting and having fatal accidents. That's only going to increase as people become more and more connected. It's going to be more and more of a part of our ordinary lives that we're going to be in this sort of data cloud that follows us wherever we go.
Good word for it. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, there's no stopping that. And those folks are going to be, I think, real interested in a car that will just take over while they do their texting.
Yeah.
Or at the least sense danger and either hit the brakes at the appropriate moment. If they're, you know, if a car in front stops, in front of you on the highway stops too abruptly or slows down too quickly and you're texting and you don't notice that, the car can see that. That's the technology they have that they've developed through these races. The car will see that and go, uh-oh, if we keep going at this speed, we're going to hit those guys.
Right.
Let's slow down, put on the brakes, or warn the driver. There are various ideas about how to do that, maybe vibrate the steering wheel or emit some kind of tone.
But squirt water at the driver.
Yeah, just look at the road. Sometimes you want to do that when you're driving in another car next to them on the highway. But the other group is the older generation, the baby boomers. People are getting old and eyesight may not be as good as it was, or they may have other handicaps that make it hard for them to drive. So these folks are going to be really interested in adopting this technology. It'll keep them active longer.
Now, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that, that this is, you know, for people who you can get to the pharmacy and back and not put anybody else at risk, you know, in many ways, if your eyesight's failing or if you've got blood sugar issues or other things, which we know periodically, you know, some senior will experience while driving along and end up plowing into some people at a bus stop or something. So
sure.
I can see that. I could.
You might just want to go to a party and get wasted without worrying about who's going to drive you home. You know, that's a perfectly valid reason to have an autonomous vehicle. I'd rather have a computer as awake and alert driving.
But then it would create like a whole new thing where you would be charged with inebriated programming of a vehicle.
Yeah.
That if you're drunk and you don't program it right and something should happen or you give it the wrong address or.
Well, this one of the people I met at this auto race, one of the most interesting people I met wasn't a scientist or an engineer. He was an insurance guy at a big insurance agency, and he had been sent out there to find out what's the future of insurance and auto insurance.
How about that?
And he was looking at liability issues. Well, who's at fault in an accident in which the driver can quite legitimately be asleep at the wheel?
Right. Exactly. And the car may malfunction. So then, you know, and or that there could be some sort of, what if there was some sort of burst of gamma radiation or something like that from space, and it interrupts the GPS, or it disrupts the programming on the electronics. Then what?
And we saw that happening at the Irvin Challenge, this auto race. A lot of precautions were taken to protect human bystanders from any cars that might go haywire. They had these big concrete barriers, and some of the cars did not do so well. If they lost the GPS signal for whatever reason and lost track of where they were for the most part programmed to just stop in their tracks. Okay, I don't know where I am anymore. Let me just hang out here. But that can be less than ideal too if you're on a highway.
Yeah, then you become a human pylon. You're sitting out there and there's nothing you can do about it. So some of the difference that we might see in the near future. What else did you discover in your research for the Department of Mad Scientists that you think we'll start seeing soon, the coming directly from DARPA funding?
There's a big push toward computers that can think like we do. We're, you know, HAL 9000, you know, from 2001. Hopefully not computers that will go haywire, but ones that can anticipate our needs or respond to us. I'm just watching Iron Man again for the second time. I really love that.
Yeah, great movie.
And it seems to me the writers of that movie were, in some sense, inspired by DOD research, including DARPA.
Oh, without a doubt.
I mean, Tony Stark, the defense contractor who builds this suit of armor, and some of those technologies in that armor are things that DARPA is actually working on. So he's got this computer called Jeeves that lives in his house / workshop that he just can tell it what to do. I need this, that, and the other thing. It controls the robots in his house. Those robots are sort of his workers. They can, you know, manipulate things for him, help him weld things. And then when he climbs into his armored suit, which, by the way, is a DARPA project that we're actually working on, an exoskeleton that would increase your strength. He gets in there and he just has Jeeves transfer over from his house into his suit. And then he's got all his preferences. It's at one point in the movie, he says, upload all preferences or something like that, you know, from the house interface. And that's exactly what DARPA wants to do with this program called PAL. It's called Personal Assistant That Learns. And Tony Tether, head of DARPA, when I was writing this book, had told me he had this vision where when you come into the world, even from infancy, you've got this computer that follows you everywhere, whether it lives on some device that you're wearing or it's in the house you live in. It's just absorbing information about how you process things. It's learning you, in other words, instead of the other way around. So it knows what your likes are, your dislikes. You can just tell it, I'm in the mood for pizza tonight, you know. And it will know by then, after having lived with you all this time, that it knows what kind of pizza you want. You know, I'm using a really silly example.
No, it's a great example.
But then it would follow you into your car. It already knows, hey, go to George's house, you know, and it'll just drive there, you know.
But even if all you said was, I'm in the mood for pizza tonight, and it knew automatically which pizza delivery place to call, what time you like your pizza, how you like your pizza, and then to pay for it, so that when it showed up, all you had to do is just walk over to the door, open up, take your pizza.
Exactly. Of course, huge application for military. Commanders are overwhelmed with information coming in heat of battle, whatever. They can use same kind of shorthand they would use with humans.
Right.
Subordinates with a computer, very useful, but also applicable to us, too.
Not to mention all those guys out there in those remote foxholes who could use a pizza.
Right. That's a whole other thing.
You just say pizza out there in the middle of Afghanistan. Someone would show up. That's just part of the story of our future. The Department of Mad Scientists, how DARPA is remaking our world. Michael Belfiore. More on that coming up in just a minute. The ways in which our lives might change thanks to DARPA research. And I want to go back to that Iron Man example that Michael just gave. I think there's another couple of pieces of technology in there that I wonder whether DARPA is working on next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. the Department of Mad Scientists, how DARPA is remaking our world from the internet to artificial limbs. More on that coming up in just a moment. And also, looking ahead then, DARPA will be the subject of the show that George is going to be talking about, somebody who says that they were involved in a DARPA-funded project to explore time travel. Not in Michael's book, but lots of stuff that we haven't gotten to that is coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Artificial limbs, automatic cars, and weapons that may or may not pay off sometime in the future to some of the projects that they're working on. And the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, an agency that has a kind of a, I don't know, would loosey-goosey be too strong a term to describe its outlook on how successful a project has to be in order to get funded?
That's actually, yeah, that's probably a pretty good thing. They don't have a set way of doing things. So it's whatever is the best way to explore a new idea, that's what they're going to go for.
And in the case of many of these projects we've talked about, and we don't really have an accurate gauge yet on some of the projects, because as you said, about 50% of them are top secret. We simply just don't know what they're doing, and we may not know for 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, and even people who are working there now may not know what was going on there 10 years ago because they weren't there. And
right.
There's no real institutional memory there. They're not like NASA compiling files and data and photos and video about what their past has been. They just want to keep moving forward.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem, though, too, for them, is that it's important to kind of to keep track of the things that have not worked and some of the ways in which projects have been attempted to sort of avoid the repetition of that problem for the future. But so, I mean, there's sort of a beauty about always moving forward. But, you know, we're wise to remember our past mistakes. And if there's no central historian for DARPA that's keeping track of that, there may be some redundancy in some of these types of experiments.
Sure. And it's also cuts both ways, because the things that are successful, they may not get credit for.
Right. So in the Department of Mad Scientists, we were talking about some of the ways in which DARPA is reshaping our future right now. We talked about the some of that technology for driving, et cetera. But are there some things about that that scare you? Are there some things that you read about that, you know, you're not sure whether or not they should be doing this?
Robotics is a huge area for them, always has been. I am excited about the autonomous cars, because I'd like to have one myself. But some of the robots they're working on are kind of frightening. And I think we're moving toward an age when more and more of conflict or war fighting or whatever you want to call it is going to be mechanized. And you're going to have more and more autonomy in the hands of machines that have more and more lethal weapons. And that's something DARPA is interested in. It's kind of scary now, even with UAVs that they have now, which DARPA was instrumental in getting off the ground in the 70s, unmanned aerial vehicles. Right now we have a situation where the Air Force is saying that the future of the Air Force is in these unmanned systems. And they can't train enough pilots for these things fast enough. And they're fighting in Afghanistan. You have a situation now where pilots will go to work at essentially an office somewhere in Nevada or somewhere else, just commute to work like anyone else and sit at a console at a desk and fly a machine in Afghanistan, and in some cases drop bombs and trigger weapons, as well as just go on surveillance duty. Sometimes those guys can't really see too well. They're just looking at a little video screen. It's a little square, you know, screen. Is that guy planting an IED or not? Well, I think he is. Let me just drop a bomb on him. So that, to me, is a little bit frightening. There's a group called Boston Dynamics that's working on some pretty scary stuff. It just looks frightening. It's fascinating, but a little frightening. They're working on robots that are inspired by the way animals move. They have this thing called Big Dog, and it's a big, intimidating-looking, four-legged robot that's designed to ostensibly just carry supplies for soldiers over rough terrain, but you could easily see a situation where it's got a machine gun mounted on it. You imagine like 20 of these galloping over a hill.
Sure, dogs of war, but yeah. Mechanized dogs of war.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I mean, we all want people to fewer people to die, and it would be nice if, you know, maybe enough of these developments were a deterrent that, you know, this meant fewer wars. But that, you know, to quote Rocky and Bullwinkle, you know, that trick never works. So, you know, we always, when we develop these new technologies, we end up using them, and then they end to become sort of the new standard of warfare. It doesn't really ever act as a deterrent. And yet, I mean, cool is cool, too. I mean, the idea of these mechanized dogs, these big dogs loping across a battlefield, maybe even these big mechanized dogs that could retrieve soldiers. We've heard about this, these robots that are out there that would provide immediate cover for a soldier that's down, armored cover, be able to put them in some sort of remote vehicle and then bring them back, even if they're not doing surgery, just to get them off the battlefield faster.
That's a tremendous. That would, you know, that would be great for us too. Like, highway accident, helicopter comes in. Suppose that helicopter had some kind of equipment on that could keep somebody alive on the way to the hospital. That's what DARPA is working on. That could have application for us. But they're also, this is another interesting thing though. They, like I said, they're not going to just do one set way of doing things. In other words, the mission isn't let's just create better weapons or better ways to protect our soldiers. Let's go further. Why don't we try to find ways to prevent those folks from even having to go into harm's way to begin with? What better way to secure our country and our soldiers than by doing that? So a big thrust of theirs right now is alternative energy. And they're quite upfront about this, that if we can develop our own renewable supplies of energy, hey, we might not have to go secure oil supplies halfway around the world. Well, let them have it. Let them fight over it. We got our own power here. So the vision is that soldiers could go anywhere in the world, deploy, set up camp, and just draw all of their energy needs right from the environment. And of course, that would have tremendous application for us too. What if your house could do that?
You know, right.
What if your car could do that? And they're looking at all kinds of technologies for that.
Of course, we have some, you know, geothermal technologies right now that we could be employing more of that would cut down a lot on our dependence on foreign oil, or solar or wind or some of these other things that that have already been implemented, but don't necessarily, I mean, they're growing in popularity, but they got a long way to go before it could really make an impact on the amount of, you know, barrels of oil that we're importing every day. You'd have to get people on board with some of these, you know, home nuclear devices, right? Some of these power plants that they're working on, where you would have essentially your own reactor in the basement and provide perpetual energy for the house. Or anything on that you saw with DARPA?
Interesting. I didn't see any fusion or advanced nuclear power projects. It's not, you know, that doesn't mean they're necessarily not working on those things. I just wasn't allowed to see them. But I suspect the reason is that that stuff is too far out. You know, I was talking to a nuclear physicist not long ago who was saying, yeah, we're 50 years away from practical fusion power. And they've been saying that, of course, for 50 years.
Right.
And yeah. DARPA is real interested in stuff they can get online pretty quickly within, you know, 4 or 5 year time frame. This is a typical time frame that a program manager is allowed to stay at DARPA. So he wants to get his project off the ground while he's there. So what they're looking at is advanced solar power. So they've created a project to develop solar cells that are 50% efficient. This is unheard of, right? You can get a commercial system that's maybe up to 20% efficient. So in other words, 20% of the energy from the sun hitting it turns to electricity. They want to go 50%. At that kind of level, you could power all of a soldier's equipment, this is what they're interested in, without batteries. Just have their GPS or whatever communication system covered with solar panels. Hey, they don't need batteries. You know, a soldier's load is typically about 20% batteries, which is crazy, you know, out of a 100-pound load. So there's that. And there's also, they've created the world's first renewable jet fuel, which is, to me, just astounding. It's essentially like vegetable oil. They start with vegetable oil and create this stuff that runs in jet engines at high altitude, very low temperatures, high energy density. It's really demanding application for fuel. They've pulled this off.
And that would interest me more if it were used vegetable oil. So that it didn't, we weren't taking away from one, you know, project to, you know, we weren't taking away food stuff, which could be helpful to, you know, feed the planet, and then using that for something like fuel. That would be cool if once you have to take a byproduct and be able to turn it into a primary fuel source.
Well, now, of course, they can do that, but now they've thought of this, of course, and that their next project is to create, now we know how to create high-performance fuel out of vegetable oil. Now, let's get that vegetable oil from non-food sources. In other words, something we can grow easily. It doesn't depress,
right,
you know, markets or whatever for food, or increase the market, whatever.
Right.
So they want to create oil out of algae.
Yeah, the algae farms. We've been hearing about these. Are very interesting, especially because the algae farms are growing vertically.
Yeah, you can grow those things anywhere there's sunlight and a supply of carbon dioxide. So then you can pipe in carbon dioxide from a power plant and capture the carbon that would ordinarily just shoot up into the atmosphere. Now we can reuse it and create another type of fuel. So
This is being done through DARPA. Some of these projects are being funded by DARPA, because we've heard about these a little bit. We've talked about them. Yeah, because the cool thing about doing them vertically is, of course, you just need, you know, less acreage, and so the algae grows almost as fast as you can turn around and use it, which I think is even cooler.
But yeah,
you got essentially you're pumping live algae out almost, you know, shortly after it's been created. It doesn't need a lot of time to ferment in order to be useful. The Department of Mad Scientists, that's a book from Michael Belfiore. We're talking about some of the ways in which our future is going to change. We mentioned the exoskeleton and the sort of Iron Man-like device, which we've seen in a couple of different movies. The idea that that there would be a light, bulletproof, some sort of polymer on the outside, which would be powered. And the source would, like, say, double the strength or triple the strength of the soldier, so that they could, you know, become essentially like ants, where our power ratios would be adjusted dramatically. So we could run faster, jump higher, be able to lift more, carry more over long distances. And at the same time, these would be smart suits, so that we would be linked to each other. We'd be able to see where everybody else was. I mean, it could cut down a lot on friendly fire incidents. And it would essentially take human beings and turn them into super soldiers. Now, let me ask you a question about this. Does DARPA ever get into an ethics department? Do they ever? I mean, I think that's totally cool, and don't get me wrong, but are there times, is there anywhere along the line at DARPA where they have, like, a committee that reviews the ethics of any of these projects?
As far as I know, there's not. That may be a stumbling block for them. In fact, that came up to bite them in the early 2000s with a program called Total Information Awareness. Maybe you remember this. This was after 9/11, and Tony Tether, who had just come in as head of DARPA, thought, you know, there's got to be the data out there that somebody just missed that would have pinpointed those terrorists before they acted. And he created a program to try to mine data across all government computer systems that were already tracking data but weren't being correlated across law enforcement and all kinds of other places. Let's create a way of sifting through that and then flagging potentially risky people, risky activity before it goes down. And the press seized on this and thought, well, this is what you're talking about, right? This ethics. This is spying and collecting dossiers on people who may be innocent, and that's not right. And, Tether almost lost his job. That program got canceled. He had to go up in front of the Senate hearings and, you know, basically justify DARPA's existence, because the Congress people were wondering, okay, well, is this the tip of the iceberg? What other projects is this agency working on that we don't know about that might have some real problems, you know?
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, I totally get that. I mean, I think there's a perception anyway that anytime the government is going to do something like that when it comes to privacy, that there's some sort of checks and balances within an agency that says, oh, nope, we don't want to do that one. And so, you know, I don't know whether that's ever part of DARPA's mission to someday develop a department of bioethics or, you know, any sort of review group that might come in and say, what if you did it 10% less this way and 40% that way? And then you think, well, if they really get into that, then maybe they're going to ruin the beauty of the organization in the first place.
That's right. As far as I know, there is no agency or system
committee
within there.
Right.
That's both a strength and a weakness, I guess, because, you know, minimal bureaucracy means things get done quickly. And that's their goal. You know, like I say, we were talking about how the internet started. It was just a guy with an idea walking down the hall to the head of DARPA and pitching it. The guy just signed off on it there and then. But you're right. If there are questions that might concern other people, they may not hear about those things. It's too late.
It'd be easy to overthink everything and just in the end say no. Just keep saying, no, nah, well, we better not. So, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky balance, but that's part of what this agency's been about from the very beginning. Better, in a way, I mean, to create it. In some cases, they've created things which they didn't even really have an application for, correct? I mean, things they came up with, and they're like, well, how do we use this now?
Yeah, and that's, you know, there's just as much of a social or political or policy question as a technological one. You create this new thing, what do you do with it? The people at DARPA see their job as almost as much sales as development. How do we convince people that they need this thing, like this GPS that fit in the pocket? Well, that's something they created that had a pretty obvious application, but not everything does.
Right.
And the head of DARPA that I interviewed for my book, Tony Tether, told me that one of his main qualifications, he felt, besides being an electrical engineer, was that he was once a Fuller Brush man.
Oh, interesting.
He saw his job as knocking on doors, right, convincing people to buy things they didn't think they needed. Because
right.
He felt they did.
Right. Yeah. And that and they were practical things. And the Fuller Brush, I don't even know if there are still Fuller Brush people that go around, but I remember when the Fuller Brush man would come once a year, and my mother would always sort of buy something out of pity more than anything else. She always felt sorry for the guy. But they were always practical things. I mean, things, but she could just as easily have bought them at the drugstore. But, you know, there's something about the way that the guy did it that she felt like she had to support him. So so they did. But that's interesting because I wonder whether there aren't certain things that have died on the vine at DARPA that were very cool, that were completed projects that were successful, it's just they didn't have an application. Are there any that come to mind?
Well, one that I know about was written in this, by the way, it's very, the only other book I know about besides mine about the history and the future of DARPA is a commissioned study by DARPA itself that was commissioned in the mid-70s, and you can download it from the Department of Defense. Big tome, 700 pages or something like that, but it has some fascinating detail in it. One of these was during the Vietnam War, when a DARPA program manager decided he wanted to create basically a mechanical elephant. So they saw folks in, you know, in Vietnam had all these animals, pack animals, like elephants, that could just crash through jungle underbrush and carry lots of supplies in where a truck couldn't. So DARPA thought, wow, this is great. You know, let's create a mechanical version of this. And right, this is coming back to what we were just talking about, these pack mules that are actually being built now called Big Dog. So these ideas do come back. But at the time, it was, once it came to light that they were working on this, it was widely ridiculed. And just people just felt this is a ridiculous waste of our money. These folks are building mechanical elephants.
And in the end, was there not any way to use that? Or do they not take, can they transfer that technology into something else?
I think that got nipped in the bud just because once it came to light, it was so reviled that the pressure was put on them to cancel it.
Well, I think that'd be cool. I'd like to have a big mechanical elephant. I think got to find a way to use that. They may want to they should revisit that. The Department of Mad Scientists should take another look at the mechanical elephant. They're doing everything else. How DARPA is remaking our world from the internet to artificial limbs. So much more in the book, Michael Belfiore. We'll get to your questions and comments about DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And you'll find out more next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.